Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, August 23rd, 2020. Happy birthday to the late, great Kobe Bean Bryant. Subscribe to the show wherever you listen. If you like it, give it 5 stars. Let everybody know why you like it, because it gives me a reason for doing this, and it makes me feel good about the life decisions that I've made. Those decisions that got me where I am, in an apartment in New Jersey, away from all of my family and friends. So please rate the fucking thing. I'm not asking you for money. If you want more content, you can subscribe to Patreon, because that's a couple hundred, that's a hundred, it's at least 3 years of content that you have available at the ready if you just put down $3 a month. That's the price of, is it a price? What is it? The price? It's not that much. It's like, it, can you get a coffee for that much now? I don't know, but it's $3 a month. It helps. It helps the show. And it gives me a reason for doing this. And I appreciate those of you that have subscribed and that have rated the thing. And it makes me feel, it just makes a brother, hey, do you want to make a black guy feel good? How about you subscribe to Patreon, you rate and review the podcast. And that's all I'm going to say about it. This is episode 445. I have a super special return guest. You know him, you love him. He's a writer. And he's got a forthcoming memoir coming out that's tentatively titled, that you'll find out if you keep listening to this episode. And he's a new black dad, Morgan Campbell. I'm gonna share that conversation that I had with him, with you, in a bit. I've said this on the Patreon feed, and I'm gonna shift some of that here because there's more of you that listen. This is a wider base of the couple hundred people that listen to this show. Who makes the best tortilla chips that I can buy in a store? Now, the consensus of the handful of people that have responded to my tweet and Facebook, they say the Tostitos tortilla chips with a hint of lime. And I like those, but is there another tier? That's all I'm asking. Is there another tier? Is there another tier from that? Because if not, I'm just going to go with that. I've heard, and I got this confirmed from friend of the show, Don Will, that there is a tortilla chip that you can find at Trader Joe's that's some of the best that you can buy. On a retail level. I'm not talking about your restaurant tortilla chips that you just randomly get at your hole in the wall Mexican place that's by a jail. RIP to La Frontera Mexican restaurant that used to be across from the Hackensack jail, and next door to a bail bondsman. That was some of the best Mexican food I've ever had in my life, and they are not there anymore. I think they left before the pandemic. It was in a weird spot. Parking was weird. So whatever. Not those kind. Obviously, you can. Those are incredible. But where can I go consistently from a retail standpoint and get some really good tortilla chips? If I can't, I'm trying to have a fun Taco Tuesday. I'm trying to do that. And I've got the stuff. I got the fixings. I've got some mission style tortillas, and so I'm excited about that. I'm going to have a Taco Tuesday. If they're good, if they're good enough, if they look good, and they will be good. It's not like I haven't done them before, but if they look good, I will post them on Twitter and Instagram. We'll see. I mean, if I can make a next level prime rib, I'm pretty sure I can make some tacos. All right. You know, that's how, you know, I feel like I can do that. So I'm going to try those. I wanted to go to Trader Joe's. I got up early. I went to the grocery store. I said to myself, let me take it to social media and ask. And I thought about that. I thought about those Tostitos, and that's what I'll do. I'll probably get those tomorrow or something. But I thought about those, and somebody told me about Don Will confirmed that it was Fonte of the Foreign Exchange and Little Brother. May the Lord watch in stores wherever you buy your music. Catalog of Foreign Exchange, fantastic. Fonte is also a friend of the show. He said one time, Don Will confirmed that it was Fonte that said that Trader Joe's has the best tortilla chips. And so I was going to go after I got done at Stop and Shop. There's a Trader Joe's minutes away, but they weren't open. It was a quarter till 9 and they didn't open till like 10 or 11. I think they opened at 10. Then there's another Trader Joe's in Paramus that's like the bigger one. And I went to that one. There was a line wrapped around the building, and I was like, fuck that, I'm not gonna do that. So I think maybe tomorrow I'll go to the smaller one and see if I can get in there. They're remodeling that place, and I remember the one and only time that I went to that Trader Joe's, I was getting like boxed out like I was going up for a rebound the whole time. It was like fucking bumper cars going in there. So I'm gonna brave that Trader Joe's and try to find the nachos. Now I googled Trader Joe's nachos, and I tried to find, I think apparently there's different types. There's longboard organic tortilla chips. There's yellow corn tortilla chip rounds. I don't think I would want the rounds, but there's the restaurant style that looks like the kind that's supposed to be good. Oh, and they do have lime. Holy shit. This must be the one he was talking about. Restaurant style white corn tortilla chips. And it has a little fucking lime on it. So I'm thinking that this is the kind. So I'm just going to have to wear some shoulder pads when I go into this fucking Trader Joe's tomorrow. And you know, I'm a big black guy. You say, Chris, you're a big black dude. Why would you care if anybody's gonna box you out? Yeah, we're in a pandemic, but why would you? People, they don't give a shit. They will knock your ass. They don't care. I think in grocery stores, they don't give a fuck. Old middle aged and old white women will run you over, and you know they'll manhandle you. So that's on the agenda this week. Madden comes out this week. I gotta get Madden, I guess. Yeah, I gotta get, because Lamar Jackson's on the cover. I have to get it. So I'm excited to play that eventually. I don't know if I'm gonna get it right away. I don't know. I might. Who? I don't know. What else did I want to say? Yeah. So give me your thoughts on that. Yeah, give me your thoughts on your favorite nacho. I mean, your favorite tortilla chips. Let me know about that. Hope everybody did you watch the DNC? I fell asleep. I'm not trying to be a contrarian. I just watched some of the speeches on YouTube. Playoffs are going. I fell asleep on those. I've got ESPN, but NBA TV on mute, watching the replay of the Lakers and the Blazers. You guys don't give a shit. Let's just get to Morgan Campbell. Morgan is a friend of the show, and he's been on several times. He was on a really terrific episode that we did last year, talking about, a Patreon episode. Speaking of Patreon, we did a really great episode talking about black hockey, and that was really, really great. Morgan's one of those guys, I would say, like, he's one of the rotating people that really make the... I've had smart people come on the show, but a guy like Morgan, you know, I would say JL and Rod, they make the show smarter, and that's what I appreciate about every time I get them on. it just makes the show better. And that's what I like to do with this show. Like, I'm just a guy. I'm just a guy that, you know, I think I'm charming. I'm somewhat charming. I'm a somewhat charming guy, and I'm a good host. I think I ask good questions. Some people would even say that this podcast is really good. I would say that. You know, I have to, if I don't pick myself up, who's going to do that? I think this is a good show. When I have guys like that on the show, it makes it better. It just makes the show better. And I think you get a really cool perspective when you have a guy like Morgan on. And I mainly wanted Morgan to be on the show this week because I wouldn't say he forced me, but he edged me on to watch the latest season of Last Chance U. Now, I was going to watch it, but he was watching it a couple weeks ago, and he was just like, yo, are you watching? And I was like, oh, shit, I guess I got to get on this. And then I started watching this latest season, and I was like, yo, we got to talk about this. We got to talk this. I've never experienced something like this season of Last Chance U. And it can be really deceptive in a lot of ways, that it's not just this episode, this season isn't just your standard issue reality TV sports show. There's so many different things that we talked about. And I alluded to it last week when we were talking. I talked to you in the intro about like Stockton, California. I recommended that Stockton on My Mind documentary. And we had this great conversation. I love talking to Morgan. If you've never heard him on the show, make sure you follow him. Make sure you support what this guy is doing. I can't wait to read his book when it comes out. I'm really just excited to share this episode. This one is one for the history books, folks. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with the great Morgan Campbell. How is life for you in Canada? How much better is it for you being our upstairs neighbor than it is on us? How are people treating everything?
One, like, we're lucky in that people have taken COVID fairly seriously. Like, even you do have a lot of conservatives here, and like among people that I'm friends with on Facebook and friends of friends, you do see like the COVID conspiracy theorists, mm-hmm. and anti-mask people and all this. But by and large, there's just been so much more buy-in to wearing masks,
yeah,
around Toronto than there has, you know, than there's been clearly like in Florida or Texas or whatever. So we're lucky enough where we live that, you know, the disease is hardly spreading at all anymore. Like, Toronto's a big city. Toronto has 5 million people,
right?
And they're getting, you know, 4 or 5 new cases a day. That's it. Because I got tested the other week because I had to go to the doctor,
right?
You know, and that's the first thing they're going to ask you anyway is, have you had been tested? So I just got tested. It was easy. My, you know, you make an appointment. There's no lineup. The appointment was for 4 p.m. I was out by 4:06.
Yeah.
So then when I watched the news and see what's happening in Florida, see what's happening in Texas, and I see that they're making it harder to get tested in Texas because they think that's going to drive the number of positive cases down. But all it's going to do is just allow more people to get more sick. And then when you get sick and show up at the doctor and say, I have all these systems, they're going to test you anyway.
Right.
So you're still going to get the positive cases. It's going to be a lot more sick people. And so, especially as a dual citizen, I was explaining this to somebody the other week, but what I feel like is a lot of like survivor's remorse that I'm here and that, you know, so many of my friends and family are still down there dealing with this stuff. Like,
yeah,
there's like where I live, there are two places within walking distance where I can send mail. Mm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And people on the other side of the border can't take that for granted anymore, which is literally a crime.
Yeah.
And so I feel lucky to be where I am. But again, I do feel really guilty knowing what everyone on the other side of the border has to deal with, and that, you know, that could be me. And that is a lot of my family.
Right.
But I'm not one of these Canadians that's going to gloat to Americans about how much better Canadians have it right now. Only because my family's American. I'm a dual citizen. So it's not for me to gloat. Like, I feel really bad. I feel like, sort of like how when I would talk to my friends from Venezuela and how they would talk about their family stranded in Venezuela and how they couldn't go see the doctor and how, like, if you were rich, you could fly to Miami, you know, and get baby formula, mm-hmm. like that. But at home, that stuff was really scarce.
Yeah.
And I like, the direction the United States is trending, like, I don't know what's going to distinguish, like, 5 years from now, I don't know what's going to distinguish the United States from all these countries that people leave to move to the United States.
Right. I mean, well, you've always been, and since I've known you, being a dual citizen, you've always been measured in your opinions on Canada as a nation and the U.S. So, especially, I know a lot of our talks, we tend to talk about race and how shit's not always so sweet as you think it is, yeah. in Canada.
Right.
And
right.
And it's you know, because the trend at least 4 years ago was, oh, I'm going to Canada. It's like, they might not want your ass up there either. You know, you know, and different. And I know you can speak to the racism and stuff. But as far as the virus is concerned, I've noticed that, you know, even here in where I live in Bergen County in New Jersey, which is supposed to be one of the richest counties in the state, I've noticed that there's been reports of spikes because people are having these parties and stuff. They're having all these gatherings, and months ago they were, when you speak about the ease of the testing, we have, like, our, I think one of our big venues in, like, central, I guess you would call it central Jersey, the PNC Bank Arts Center. It's like one of those pavilions that you know, have big, like, summer concerts and stuff. Yeah. They had that was a testing site a couple of months ago, where it's just like people from all over the state would come to get testing, and people, lines would be, you know, wrapped around, you know, the highway and all that stuff. And the way that it like, just the way that, like, the country is so fragile, where we're not as strong as we thought we were. This is how everything, like, the system's breaking down, and people are, you know, lining up for food and everything like that. And it's interesting, like, cars lined up for food, and you could see the type of cars that are in line, like luxury cars, you know, trying right. to get food. And it's just like, damn, it's like 3 to 4 months, and it's just, the shit's already broken. And now we're trying to save the Postal Service. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, again, which is, I remember being a kid and reading the Guinness Book of World Records, and the longest prison sentence ever handed down in the court was to a mailman in Spain, and his crime was not delivering the mail. He would just take people's mail and dump it. So they sentenced him to, like, 7 years for every letter he didn't deliver.
Holy shit!
Right, and here we have a president saying, "Well, I am defunding the Postal Service because the Democrats think that'll help them win the election," which it will, but that's not a reason to defund the Postal Service. Like, it's not the Democrats' problem. It's not illegal that more people like Biden and Harris than like Trump and Pence.
Mm-hmm.
Not against, well, in a perfect world, that's not against the law. In the world that Donald Trump is trying to build, it might soon be against the law for more people to like the other guy than to like Trump. But as long as we have the laws we have, that's not against the law. And I don't have, I'm not the first one to bring up, like, how many other people and how many other functions, right, don't get carried out because this guy's sabotaging mail service. Like, how many people don't get their disability checks? How many people don't get their bills paid because they send a check in and it takes months?
Right.
How many people don't get their stimulus check? My mom got a stimulus check this week, like the $1,200 check that was going out earlier in the spring. My mom just arrived last week.
Well, she's in the U.S. obviously, right?
No, she's here in Canada, but she gets Social Security because she's retired.
Okay. Okay.
So they gave her the check. And so, it's illegal and it's inhumane, but folks treat it like it's something normal.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the president's doing it. And again, if this was happening in another country with a leader who was whose skin had more melanin or who didn't speak English as a first language, same set of accents, Americans in general, the mainstream media for sure, would treat it much differently.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I'll never get over in a lot of ways that I'll never get over that Seattle Seahawks not giving Marshawn the ball in the Super Bowl. I'll never get over the 2016 election, man. I'll never get over it. Was there tampering? Probably, but for the most part, collectively, we didn't do our job. We didn't do our job by like not voting for that dude. And everybody thought it was fun in games. You know, I used to say on stage, it's like, he's like a gremlin that you fed after midnight. You fed this, I forgot what the hell I said, but like people just thought it was so funny, but it's not, he's a monster.
Right. Yeah. It's not funny at all. And again, it's only because he's American and white and a male and English is his first language with his accent. But this was Duterte in the Philippines. This was, what's my man's name in Venezuela? Nicolas Maduro. The way all of these acts would be portrayed and perceived in North America would be very different.
Yeah.
People would just call him what he is, which is a dictator and an authoritarian. And someone who is willing to let citizens of his country die rather than allow a free and fair election. And there are no other words for someone who does that other than authoritarian, other than dictator. That's it.
I always
feel he avoids this label because he's white and American and he speaks English.
You're absolutely right. And I always feel like just as a black person, and it's easy that you can say black person or person of color, but just this is the life I've lived for 40 years. I always feel like black people, we're always the canary in a coal mine.
Yeah.
We're always, it's just so, it's become so hack to be like, if he was black, XYZ. But nobody seems to get it. I think now people kind of get it.
Well, people get it now because crippling USCIS is an act of voter suppression that affects everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So when Republicans were finding ways to suppress voting among black people, where black people live, it wasn't a problem. You just shrug your shoulders. Or when black people didn't vote in sufficient numbers to defeat Donald Trump, you blame the black people for not voting instead of blaming all the white people that voted for Donald Trump. Because all these white people who voted for Donald Trump could have voted for somebody else.
Yeah.
They chose not to. So don't blame black people for not saving white people from this really bad decision. First of all. Second of all, like how many black people had the voting process complicated for them or put beyond their reach because of all these different techniques.
Right.
But back then, 4 years ago, it was abstract. But to your point about the canary in the coal mine, the people who work to suppress the vote, the people who benefit from fewer people voting, now can move. They saw that it worked with black people, so now they try it with other people.
Right.
This is what happens with the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
Send them down there. Is it safe? Will it work? Perfect. It worked. All right. The rest of y'all go down there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I just haven't been able to get over that. And I think, you know, at being black, because I can only speak from this perspective, although I can understand the plight and other people's perspective because I'm a person of color. I just feel like that we, God, where the hell was I going? I thought I was falling in love with the shit that I was saying, and I don't even remember the thought that I had.
Sometimes.
I just understand that, but it sucks. I mean, that's basically, no, I know what I was gonna say. It's just that we have to continue to live. And as black people, that's what we do. And it's almost like I take pride in it that the on the Still I Rise type of vibe, but it still sucks. You know what I mean? It sucks that we have to live that way. You know what I mean?
Yes, because when we talk about all the stuff Black people have overcome, we're also talking about stuff that was happening like 100 years ago. We lived through the Klan, we lived through Jim Crow. Yeah, we did, but that was 100 years ago. We shouldn't still be having to fight similar battles in a different form like
right
today. Yeah. Yet here comes, you know, the stuff we're up against. And what it shows me too is that like Black Americans, as a group, have not gone as soft as our demelanated fellow citizens have. Think about the fact that when the coronavirus first hit,
yeah.
I remember the phrasing people use, this is like a war. And Donald Trump said, yeah, I feel like a wartime president. This is like World War II, us versus the virus. Look how quickly people gave up that fight because it was inconvenient.
Yes.
And so the same guys who want to tell us that we need to play college football because our forefathers were tough enough to beat the Nazis. Okay, but like the college football players, they signed up to play football. They didn't sign up to die. Whereas
right.
soldiers often got drafted and they didn't have a choice about whether or not
yeah.
they were going to risk their lives. That's the first thing. The second thing is like during World War II, people made sacrifices. People lived with inconvenience. They rationed food.
Right.
Right. People who didn't used to work out in like, have jobs outside the home. Like women had to go get jobs outside the home because the dudes were out fighting. Dudes were getting drafted into the army, all this stuff. So people understood that to win the war, they had to get comfortable with discomfort and inconvenience. And this whole, like the era we're living through now shows me that a lot of Black people can still do that.
Yeah.
But our demelanated fellow citizens would rather risk making everyone sick than wear a 95-cent mask. Because that level of discomfort is too much. But then, but those same people want to lecture the rest of us about how tough people used to be. Yeah, the people used to be tough. What happened to you? You can't wear a mask.
That's a great point.
Right?
Yeah, because there was something on, somebody posted it on Twitter. God, I don't know what decade it was, but there was some disease going around and people were just wearing masks. And it was in the U.S.
Yeah, and then during the Spanish flu,
yeah,
that pandemic 100 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And you can see pictures of people at like Major League Baseball games and all the fans are wearing masks,
right?
And so
yeah, I don't, that's a great point. Yeah, I don't get it, like, because we just wear a mask, we're resilient and we're trying to exist in life, and it's I don't know how it got politicized. I don't know how, like, just wearing one got politicized.
How it got politicized, because lots of issues of fundamental decency and human rights that should transcend politics get politicized in the United States by people on one end of the political spectrum. So like me, to the extent that I'm still a journalist, like I'm not supposed to take a side in partisan matters, but it is an objective observation.
Right.
That issues that become politicized often, more often than not, that politicization comes from the right wing of the U.S. political spectrum.
Yeah.
And so that's your answer. That's how these things become politicized.
Okay. Yeah, that, I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, I knew the answer, but I wanted you to expound on it and say it better than I could, you know?
Well, think about this, too. Like, The I can't wear a mask because I have a medical condition, people.
Yeah.
Right? If I'm that person, if my breathing day to day is compromised to the point where if I wear a little thin mask, I can't breathe at all, then I should be the biggest, loudest, most strident advocate of everybody else wearing a mask.
Right.
Because my breathing is already compromised. So if I get a whiff of the COVID, I'm done.
Yeah.
So if I really have this medical condition, I can't be Mr. No One Wear a Mask, right? I can't be masks are fascism. I can't be that guy.
Yeah.
Because clearly I have compromised breathing. If I get a sniff, I'm done. So I want everybody to wear a mask, but that's not what we see. We see, oh, I have a medical condition. I can't wear a mask, so no one can wear a mask. Well, then you don't have a medical condition. medical condition is that you're a wimp. That's it.
Yeah.
And as much as people from the right wing of the U.S. political spectrum love to rail about personal responsibility, like, the people who don't wear masks are the ones that, one, are abdicating their personal responsibility, and two, just depending on someone else to clean up the mess, which is the opposite of what conservatives preach.
Mm-hmm.
Responsibility for yourself, your actions determine your outcome. There's nothing systemic about anything. It's just you and your personal worth and your work ethic and your toughness. Okay, cool. So then wear a mask, right? Because that's what you can, that's your personal responsibility. Otherwise, you're just going to let the virus spread and then go run to the hospital when you get sick. Run to the hospital when you make your partner sick and say, fix this for me.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, again, the absolutely exact opposite of personal responsibility. And that's the other thing that this current series of crises have revealed, is like how much of what conservatives preach and pretend to value is garbage, is untrue.
Yeah.
Because they don't care about personal responsibility, because if they did, they would wear a mask. And they are not conservative per se. They're conservative in what they want to allow other people to do, but they're very happy to take risks with my health, your health, other people's health.
Right.
Like the idea that you should just roll the dice on coronavirus, that's not a conservative thing to do. That's a very risky thing to do.
Yeah.
Conservative means risk averse, so you should be happy to wear a mask, but... Let me stop.
No, I get it, man. It's baffling to me because I've been saying it for months now, everybody's been affected by this virus, whether you got it, whether you know somebody that lost it, whether you're losing out on money or your jobs, or everybody is being affected. That's why it's a pandemic. So you can't do certain things that you would want to do. Like my thing was, you know, I was going to be working on this play. I was going to, you know, like pay some bills and stuff. And I thought like, oh, once the play is over, I wanted to, of all places, I wanted to go to Minneapolis to go to the Guthrie Theater to see that, you know, theater and to see a play. Because I'd never been to Minneapolis before. And Minneapolis was like, you know, kind of like the hotbed of, you know, civil unrest, if you will.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's just like, well, I can't do that. So I have to, you know, the shit that I like to do is just kind of shut down anyway. But
yeah,
I'm a homebody anyway. So it's like, okay, it's not that bad for me, but still, I would like to be doing certain social things, like, you know, like going to concerts, let alone take away the fact that I'm a performer. A lot of that stuff's been shut down. I had some buddies go to a cookout. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing?
Right.
But I was like, I love you guys. Be safe, but I can't.
Right. Like I can live without a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
The gym.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to the gym. I'm not letting people breathe on me from the next treadmill. I'm not touching these weights that you coughed your hand and touched on. I'm going to run around the neighborhood. I got some little kettlebells for my basement. Swing the kettlebells around, and that's how I stay in shape. Is it perfect? It's not perfect, but it's better than risking getting sick. You know, I like to go to the cafe.
Yeah.
Do I do that now? No. Like, there's one down the street from me, and they had, like, you can go on the patio and like there's very limited seating indoors. I might do that if nobody else is in there.
Right.
But otherwise, like, I live with the inconvenience. I've made this point before. I might have made it on Rod and Karen's podcast.
Uh-huh.
Like, we, and like the sports world in particular, because I do sports journalism, but they treat this pandemic the way the Golden State Warriors treated Kevin Durant's Achilles tendon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remember he had that calf injury in the 2019 playoffs?
Yes.
And he missed a bunch of time, and it got to the finals, and the Warriors went down 3-1 or whatever it was. And the team decided it was time for him to play. The man had an injury. Like, the man's injury, his tissues are damaged. The tissues don't know that it's game five. They just know that they're injured. And they're not going to change their timetable because you have a big game.
Mm-hmm.
And they send him out there because they figured game five, it's a big game. What could it hurt? And then he tore his Achilles tendon because, of course, he tore his Achilles tendon because he was injured. Because your timetable has nothing to do with, you know, the health of his tissues. So here we are in North America, especially in the U.S., especially in the South, where people want to play college football. And they say, well, it's been 6 months of pandemic. That's time.
Yeah,
let's go back to normal. The pandemic does not care. It does not have your calendar. It doesn't have your timetable. And so people go back out and do what they want to do. And then you see these spikes in cases. Or you see places like Texas where they just test fewer people. And you just have all these people still dying, still getting sick. But it doesn't show up in the number, in the raw number of cases. But this is dangerous, and again, it's cowardly, is what it is.
Yeah, it is. It is, and those same people. There were people that were saying, you know, Kevin Durant's a pussy. He's not. He needs to play. He's soft. And then they're like, oh man, he's hurt. Oh my god.
Exactly.
Oh no.
Exactly. Like, when you have an injury, you got to do stuff different, period. That's it. If I break my leg, I can't just walk outside. My leg is broken. I need to go on crutches for a while. It's going to be inconvenient, but this is what it is. And this is where we are at in society. But people, the same people who say they need to go back to work because they don't have any money, but also need to go out and spend money at these restaurants and go in the bar.
Yeah.
Right? Because the big difference, too, between the people who catch and spread COVID because they're in a really crappy position with work, like they're the guys that work in the slaughterhouses or whatever.
Right.
And because we are greedy and we're cheap and we're entitled, we say, don't shut down production. Don't allow these guys to take days off because we still want what we want, cheap and convenient. And so people, they have to go to work when they're sick and they wind up spreading the disease. That's one thing. In that sense, I don't blame. There's no way you can blame, you know, people who wind up in that situation. But people trying to go to the bar,
mm-hmm.
you've been crying to me for how many months that you got no money, but you got to go to the bar money, and now you're gonna go spread the disease. Why should I feel sorry for you? You should have to heal yourself. Jeez.
Yeah, like go to the liquor store or go to the grocery store. I mean, I think alcohol is going up.
All these places deliver, man.
Yeah.
You got to drink. You get your booze at home.
Right. It's not the same. Like, I'm a occasional drinker. Like, I have a couple Blue Moon Tall Boys in my fridge and some Woodford Reserve around, but it's like, it's not, yeah, you just have to do that shit at home. I don't know, or quarantine with people that you can drink with. I don't know, but that I know like all the grocery store prices have gone up. I've noticed that. I've noticed like I don't know about alcohol that much, but I see a lot of people at the store.
But again, but this is for the personal responsibility crowd.
Yeah.
Who don't want to recognize how their actions affect all these things.
Right.
Y'all want college football in the fall and not in the spring, with all the star players playing, cool. Y'all want cheap food? Cool. You know what you got to do? Wear a mask, stay at home, wash your goddamn hands,
yep.
and help the medical professionals get control of this virus. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, it's so crazy because... People, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, but people are just, as I said, all these masks are for fascists. Fake tough guys are actually the softest, wimpiest people out here.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because they cannot endure the inconvenience and the very mild discomfort of breathing through a cloth mask.
It's so crazy, man. And it's like quarantine and being at home. It's like we have the internet, we have Netflix, PlayStation, Xbox, all these digital streaming services.
Right.
And it's like, I don't want to go. Like, you can just chill out, man.
Right.
Jesus.
Right. And there are enough, like, you know, I need live sports people. Like, there are enough sports playing. In my opinion, there are too many North American pro sports underway right now. There are enough of them to keep you occupied from now until, you know, the winter time or whatever, right?
What do you
watch? Go watch some. You know, well, I keep weird hours because I'm trying to write this book, so I got to wake up at 3 and 4 in the morning.
Yeah,
so I end up watching. You know, I see rugby from Australia, but they got the pandemic under control. Watch some Korean baseball.
Yeah,
watch some basketball. They're in a bubble. Nobody's getting sick. Hockey. They're in the hub. No one's getting sick. Let that occupy you, and just understand we're in a pandemic, and we'll get through it when we get through it. But we'll get through it a lot faster if I would just follow the guidelines.
Yeah, I'm catching up on so much TV. I'm on TV and like beating video games. I'm gonna start getting back into playing them more. What do you think of the NBA? It feels like it took them a week or two, and now they're really locked in because they're fighting with each other now. Like Dame Lillard's kind of like, I tweeted this a couple days ago. I was like, you know, the NBA is back when Damian Lillard has something to be angry about.
Right. The biggest problem for me is that this month, NBA, NHL, from noon until like midnight, they're on TV.
Mm-hmm.
All day, every day. So my little internal calendar, like in a normal world, even if I've lost track of days, if I see NBA or NHL on TV in the daytime, and I know it's the weekend. I know it's probably Saturday, maybe Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
But now it's Wednesday afternoon. I see here, oh, look, Maple Leafs and the Columbus Blue Jackets on a Wednesday afternoon. So in my body clock, every day is Saturday, so that's not helping me. But what I appreciate about the NBA, and the NHL too, those two leagues have figured out how to keep the people in the bubble healthy and keep sick people from getting in the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a public health standpoint, like that's a win. So I don't feel as bad about watching these guys play because I know they're not making each other sick. WNBA as well.
Right.
And here's the other thing for the, I need my football right now. People. And you care about the sport, like the quality of the sport. What the NBA has is NBA players. The NHL has NHL players because all the players are in there and they're not getting sick. So then you don't have to bring up a bunch of replacements who are replacements for a reason because they're not as good as the first teamers.
Right.
Whereas in baseball, you get a bunch of guys get sick. You've seen it with Miami, St. Louis. Now Cincinnati has at least one case. And so you put them on the DNP COVID list, the COVID disabled list, and then you got to bring in a bunch of people who, if they were good enough to play Major League Baseball, they would have been playing it already. Now you're not asking me to watch Major League Baseball. You're asking me to watch Minor League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I'm like the callous jerk that only cares about the quality of the product, I should feel disappointed about this.
Yeah.
Because you're giving me a second-rate product because I'm watching all these guys that couldn't make the team before. So the NBA, and you know, I'll get into my usual NBA routine, which is, you know, the play-in games I kind of followed, and the deeper it gets into the playoffs, the more attention I'll pay. And I'll have more time to pay more attention because there won't be any college football consuming entire Saturdays of my life.
Mm-hmm. Were you still into college football?
Yeah, well, I follow my alma mater, Northwestern.
Yes.
And then, certain other teams, just depending on what's on or like what the big game is that weekend, and you know, and then I'll watch the playoffs. But I don't watch as much of it as I did, say, 15 years ago. Even though there are more places to consume it.
Yeah. It seems to me that this is what I want to ask you. Do you think that you can speak on the players' union for the NHL? Do you think that the NBA is working so well because of the union or what? Like they seem to be doing well with this bubble.
This is the difference between college sports and pro sports, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that when you have a strong union, like the union can help ensure working conditions. They're gonna make sure either people don't get sick or really minimize that risk. Whereas these college teams, they don't have a union. So all they can do is hope that the people who stand to make a bunch of money off of them are also actually going to work in the player's best interest, even if working in the player's best interest costs them money.
Mm.
And that's a lot of faith to put in some people who are already at the top of an industry that makes a lot of money off of your unpaid work.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, these NBA guys, these NHL guys are getting tested every single day. Can colleges afford that?
No.
Right. Some of them, I guess, can, but there are a lot more guys on a college football team than on an NBA team. And, like, the support staffs of these teams are so much bigger than they used to be. Because this is what you can do when you get a whole bunch of money. You don't have to pay the players. You just hire other people. But all these people got to get tested, too. And so those costs are going to add up quickly. And I don't know that every team can afford to do that. And again, even the rich teams, I don't know if they can afford to do it indefinitely.
Yeah.
And they're not in a position to trim rosters because COVID is going around. So if people get sick and you just think you're going to plug in new people, then that's what you have to do. And you need more people on the roster. You can't have fewer. And this is the other thing about, again, football teams thinking that they can just play through this. In professional sport, you can bring in free agents, right? A week ago, I was just the guy working out. Oh, the Kansas City Chiefs called me. Okay, I guess I'm going to Kansas City. Mm-hmm. But college sports, you have to be enrolled at the school. You can't just bring in a free agent no matter what Florida's governor says. You can't just bring people in because they got to be enrolled at the school, right? So if I am, even if I'm at a really good school, like the rank and file students at the school aren't as good at football as the guys on the football team. If I'm Dabo Swinney, you know, I'm going to
your favorite coach.
Right. But if 15 of my guys get sick and I got to replace them, where am I going to replace them from? I can't call free agents. And there's a 0% chance that 15 people just hanging out at Clemson's campus, just going to school there, are going to be anywhere near as good as the 15 guys who just got sick. Right.
Yeah.
So I really don't know what these guys think they're doing, except they seem to think, again, that the virus is going to respect their schedule and respect the money that's at stake and just stay away because they got to make money. And we've seen in industry after industry that is the opposite of how it works.
I just feel like since I think I can track my distaste or distrust, whatever, for college football was when the Maurice Claret situation happened. And yeah. I just got disenchanted. It's not like I'm going to be on my soapbox and saying, oh my God, I can't believe they exploit these kids and everything, which they do. But I just kind of got disenchanted with it. And you just sort of see that the emperor has no clothes. I use that phrase like all the time, but it's just, I just root for these kids to do as well as they can to maybe hopefully make it to the league, get some kind of coaching job or just build their status up. Do whatever they can do in the league and in college and, you know, be decent citizens. And I hope a black guy wins the Heisman Trophy. That's all I like care about. So I just try to reduce it to that. And then, you know, every now and then I'll, you know, watch a highlight or something or kind of have it on in the background, like one of those like Pac-12 games because it's like late, right. You know?
Yes, exactly.
And I just don't have any investment in it anymore because of what you were just saying, you know? It's just kind of a bummer.
Yeah, and what the pandemic has shown us too is how much more these various college football stakeholders want from the players. The seasons are longer than they've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And the money at stake is more than it's ever been.
Yeah.
But now that there's a deadly disease on the prowl, what the stakeholders expect the players to want and expect and need in return is less than ever.
Right.
Because when the players want to get paid, it's be happy you have a scholarship. When the players say, keep me safe, it's just, well, you might get sick.
Yeah.
Just be happy with it. Or Lou Holtz says, people storm the beach at Normandy.
Oh my God, Lou. You can't play
college football? I'm like, yeah, these are two fundamentally different things. Because last year you were telling me this is my opportunity to graduate debt-free and to get an education that I didn't have to write a check for or go into debt for. And now you're telling me I should just be happy with the possibility that I'll die. In return for what? In return for what? So this is what you're asking me to accept in return for helping make you rich or keep you rich or to limit your million-dollar losses. And it's, I don't know how much less these stakeholders can expect players to want in return before the whole thing falls apart. Because if it gets to the point, like the reason it works is because even if you don't get paid, like the players say, well, I have this talent, it's marketable, I can't sell it for cash, but I can trade it for a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And there it goes. This is how I'll leverage my talent.
Right.
And now what they're saying now is what your talent buys you is a chance to maybe die, a chance to maybe catch a deadly disease.
Yeah.
Okay, so then maybe I'll just sit at home with my talent.
Yeah, that's what some guys are doing. Like I seen those, some of those players just say, I'm going to forego this year and I'm going to go into the draft.
But even like the incoming, like the high school recruits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I really need you because you're fast and big and strong. But you also might die, but I still need you. But I'm not going to pay you, but I still need you coming. Like, that's not a very good deal, right? This is like, remember Guy, Piece of My Love?
Yes.
And Aaron Hall's like, you can't have all of me because I'm not totally free. I can't tell you everything that's going on. There's a few things in my past that should not be explained. So stay with me for a little while. So if you're the girl, you're like, listen, man, you've just, what are you offering me? You just told me all this crappy stuff about yourself. You give me every reason to think I'm in danger, but I'm supposed to stay with you for a little while. For a piece of your love. Because even if I'm into you like that, I'm still only getting a piece of your love. Not the whole thing. Plus all this baggage. And this is what these college football coaches are saying, right?
Oh my God.
You might break your neck. You might get brain damage. Oh yeah, also you might die from a disease that could kill you quicker than all these other things. And but the other thing about the disease is contagious. So even though it doesn't kill you, it might kill your loved ones. But come to my campus anyway.
Yeah.
But not for money. Because if you ask for money, you're asking for too much.
Yeah, no other students are going to be there. So they're going to be working remotely.
And so, so then the question becomes, like, how does this pro sports industry in the U.S. that's built on this idea that you got to go to college first and serve this unpaid internship, essentially, like, how long does this keep going until it either collapses or someone just finds a better way? And if we were in a country where there was another lucrative market for the skills that football players, like with basketball even, players can opt not to go to college. There's a lot of ways around college into the NBA.
Right.
So if I say this 7-foot guy, hey, you might die. You might get a deadly disease that you can pass on to your loved ones. I can't pay you, but come to my school. Then the 7-foot guy can be like, listen, I'm going to take my 7 feet. And go to Italy for a year.
Yeah.
I don't need this. Take my 7 feet and go play in Spain. I don't need this
right.
You're offering me. I can go get paid. But football, you don't have that.
Yeah.
But I just don't, like, as the decision makers make more and more and expect the talent to accept less and less, I just don't know how much longer this thing holds up.
Yeah. What do you think about the, for the longest time, you know, we've been told to just, the athletes have been told to just stick to sports and when they often, like, social justice issues and often collide with sports anyway, but with who we have in office right now, it's kind of become a thing where you can't deny the fact that, these social injustice is happening, blah, blah, blah. And it's spilling into sports and everything. And sports has always been like this microcosm of society. And how do you see, like, what's your take on, I guess, like, the political activism in sports, like, now that it's become kind of more, it's become more commonplace? Because I remember you did a piece on Kaepernick in Buffalo a while ago.
It was his first game back in that season.
And I want you to, talk about it on a macro level, but then I kind of want you to start with the NHL, because I a couple, like, maybe like 2 weeks ago, the hockey player Matt Dumba did a speech. He plays with Minnesota. Who does he play with?
He plays with the Minnesota Wild.
Okay, Minnesota Wild. And like, I just randomly woke up on a Sunday and this young dude was giving this speech before a hockey game. I was like, oh shit, what's going on here?
Right. I mean, what Dumba's speech tells you is how mainstream all these discussions have become, mm-hmm. how quickly. Think about the fact that 20-something years ago, 25 years ago, I guess it was, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, mm-hmm. when he sat out the national anthem before an NBA game, he got fined.
Yeah.
And fast forward to 2020, here's Matt Dumba. The NHL literally hands him a microphone with the NHL logo on it. Sit here and make a speech about racism before the game. And one of the things that Matt Dumba said that stood out to me is that, you know, he said that George Floyd's death opened our eyes to systemic racism. And I just remember thinking, who's our? Right? Who's that open y'all's eyes to the systemic racism?
Yeah.
a lot of other people, the fact that systemic racism exists is not new.
Yeah.
But for the NHL to acknowledge this finally is new. This is the NHL especially.
Yeah.
Because there've only ever been, always a handful of black players in the league, those players face racism, and coming up they face racism. And if you interviewed any of those players at any point, they would have told you about it.
Yeah.
And even 20 years ago, I'd interview guys about racism that they faced, and they would tell me about it. But none of it ever gained traction until the end of last year, when Akeem Ali talked about the minor league coach dropping N-bombs, this other minor league coach showing up in blackface, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it only gained traction because it was like this crazy domino effect, where Toronto lost to Las Vegas, and then Toronto fired their coach. Mm-hmm. And then the good players in Toronto were like, good riddance, because this guy was a bully, and here's how toxic his workplace was. And then Ali was like, oh yeah, he that coach that just got fired was a bully. He was a mentor of this coach that bullied me. And then he went on his Twitter thread, and then that's when finally, and then after that, everywhere you look, there were black players showing up, sharing their stories about racism.
Yeah.
And my point back then was like, these guys have been saying this for 20 plus years.
Right.
The problem is it took until now for, mainstream sports media in Canada to listen. So this is not on them. This is on y'all. This is on us as an industry for not taking people seriously.
Yeah.
So it is amazing to see how mainstream that's become. And again, like, it's the difference too between Kaepernick and now is how safe it is, right?
How safe? Fake?
Safe.
Oh, safe. Okay. All right.
Safe it is to demonstrate during an anthem.
It's very safe.
Kaepernick was doing it. Yeah. Every player who did it had to worry about what the team's owner was going to say. And they also had to make this decision that they were comfortable butting heads with the team's owner in public, butting heads with the coach or whatever.
Yeah.
And now you have like the league encouraging people to do it. Let's just build it into the game day programming, right? It's part of the entertainment now. So that's a big step. So on the one hand, it's encouraging to see leagues acknowledge that, like, issues like this, again, that aren't inherently political but become politicized, but are also important to a lot of players, should also be important to the league. And, there's an executive vice president from the NHL, Kim Davis, black woman, dumb and educated. Like, if you just saw her resume, you wouldn't profile her as an NHL hire. You would profile her as an NBA or NFL hire.
Yeah.
She's with the NHL. And this is one of her jobs, is to make sure that the NHL does the right thing on issues like this. And her point was, like, the NHL alone cannot change the culture of hockey from minor leagues up, from, like, little kid leagues up to professional. But the NHL does set the example. They set the tone.
And how long has she been around the NHL?
They hired her towards the end of 2017.
Okay. Because I remember when you were on, we did a Patreon episode of us, you and I, just me just asking you questions about hockey. And about, yeah, like, because that's always, like, fascinating to me about these black people. And Matthew Dumba isn't even black. He's, like, Filipino and Romanian, yeah, and German. But I would look at him and say that he looks like my cousin. I have a cousin that's Filipino, exactly, and black. Like, he looked black, and he looked like somebody that would be in my family, you know? So I would not, you know, yeah. So, like, I was just like, oh, shit. Because as soon as I saw it, I looked him up. I'm like, damn, he's saying all that? That's a I felt like, I was like, it's okay for him to say that?
No, the NHL is like, yeah, it's more than okay for you to say. But the NHL, when I was talking to Kim Davis about it, her story I was doing, she was very explicit. She made it plain. She's like, look, the NHL is a league. We need to reach out to a younger, more diverse fan base, because the audience is evolving. If we can't evolve with the audience, then we're going to become obsolete. Mm. And a lot of brands, it took them a while to catch up with the market and with their potential customers. If you had spoken to, like, the people who are really into the data and the market trends, they could have told you, even in the Kaepernick days, even in 2016, that the brands are actually out of step with the market. So, like, all these brands who still thought it was 1990 Michael Jordan, Republicans buy sneakers too, so play super neutral on all these things, even if it's about human rights, because you might scare away the conservative shoe buyer.
Right.
What they didn't recognize is that, like, younger consumers actually want a pitch man, a pitch woman, a celebrity endorser who, like, actually stands for something.
Mm.
And doesn't pretend to be neutral.
Right.
And so Nike understood that, and they kind of moved first in terms of, like, re-signing Kaepernick and publicizing this deal when they extended his contract. But this is what the NFL, well, to a lesser extent the NFL, but the NHL and the NBA are figuring out, and what they're acting on this year. And also, that's what George Floyd showed a lot of brands.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, you had Ben and Jerry's doing what they did.
Yeah.
And this isn't to say that they wouldn't have done that before, but the sports leagues wouldn't have had the example of a Ben and Jerry's to say, oh, actually, you know what, it is safe.
Do you think Colin Kaepernick's got to be, do you think, still think, though, that Colin Kaepernick's got to kind of be pissed, or is it just that he laid the groundwork for all this of the race? What do you think?
I don't know how he himself feels about this.
What do you think? What do you think?
Well, just a lot of times it's better to be on time than be ahead of your time.
Mm-hmm.
And Kaepernick was a bit ahead of his time.
Yeah.
But I don't know that this time would have arrived if Kaepernick had not done what he did ahead of his time.
Right, right.
And so, no, because he is doing Colin Kaepernick did not do anything different from what leagues and sponsors are now encouraging people to do.
Mm-hmm.
Except that Kaepernick, I think, had done a little more reading than a lot of people who are getting microphones shoved in their face and asked to talk about social issues have done.
Right.
This is the other thing with daily sports media, is that now that this has become part of the production, part of the show, and part of what happens around the court every day, you have a bunch of people whose only expertise really is the neutral zone trap in hockey and writing about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and writing about a term my wife cracks up every time she hears it on a basketball game, writing about dribble penetration, things like this.
But now,
guys are getting into interviews and talking about systemic racism, talking about the history of voting, of black disenfranchising black voters and stuff like this. And you're like, man, I came here to write about 3-point shots. Like, yeah. I write about this. But one of the things the anthem protests do, it just provides like a really easy way and sort of a cheap way for mainstream media reporters to look like they're plugged in and look like they care. And also an easy, cheap way just to shame black athletes. So when NFL players are doing it 3 and 4 seasons ago, the easiest thing to do, you just shove a microphone in the guy's face when he kneels for the anthem, why'd you kneel? And then you write about that. And now if someone doesn't kneel, you shove a microphone in his or her face, why didn't you kneel? You write a story about that.
And you're that kid from Orlando that didn't know what the fuck to say.
But it's very low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, the mainstream media and the people just with these constant deadlines, why they adore it. Because they ain't got time to be climbing the tree. Just give me the lowest hanging fruit. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess I wanted to just make the shift to what I really wanted to talk to you about. And what we were talking about actually with the NCAA is just spilling over. You are my last chance you correspondent. To me, I'll just start.
I lost you for, hey, Chris, I lost you for a second. I lost you for about 5 seconds. Did, you said you were my,
you were,
and I didn't hear anything to that.
You were my, you're my last chance you correspondent. And you got me on to watch it like last week. We were messaging and you're like, oh, did you watch it? I was like, oh, shit, I need to watch this. And I started watching it Saturday afternoon and then finished it sometimes Sunday, the next day of last week. To me, this seems like one of the worst seasons, like as far as like just how the players, what the players had to go through. Because you can think in these small towns, like were they in Independence, Kansas, something like that?
Yes.
And then Mississippi. Like, I just say, like, those kids had it better because at least they had places to live.
Yes. That was what really bothered me. Remember, let me back up a little bit.
Yeah.
We were having this discussion offline about there's a point in every season where you recognize that the coach is actually a jerk.
Yeah.
So this season we have Coach Beam, legendary Coach Beam from Laney College, and he knows all the D1 coaches. He can get you recruited, and his thing is he works with these cast-offs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he's married. His wife is a therapist.
Right.
So she knows how to help him help the kids through, you know, whatever mental health issues that they're struggling with. Right. Mm-hmm. But you reach that point mid-season, first of all, you notice like some of the players who are struggling skill-wise, like they're not getting any better.
Yeah.
And the coach is just nagging them about stuff and like chastising them afterward instead of teaching them. A lot of their problem is that they're just not very well coached. The second thing is that this coach just keeps railing about how these kids are entitled because they wanted food or he gave them some t-shirts. He's like, see, I gave them t-shirts and now they're spoiled. Except, you know, the big subplot of this season is how a bunch of these kids are functionally homeless.
Yeah.
Right? You had two kids living in a shipping container in a gentrifying black neighborhood in Oakland. Another guy who was homeless, but his aunt and uncle took him in. But the trade-off was, you know, the aunt and uncle were the children of their famous pedophile grandfather.
Yeah.
Like the guy was an actual famous pedophile.
RJ Stern. Yeah, RJ's, RJ's the so wide receiver.
So you live with these people, right, who have also made all these excuses for why their grandfather could go molest kids. Right? These are not comfortable living circumstances. Then we have our man Dior.
Yeah.
Who works at Wingstop. So he's working and going to school and playing football, and he sleeps in his truck.
Because his father's a piece of shit.
Yes, and you watch the show. Every week, Dior gets skinnier. Dior is clearly sleep-deprived and he's hungry. And here's the coach, who on the one hand prides himself on being you know, connected to the students and able to relate to these young student athletes, et cetera, and all the tough circumstances they come from because he's from Oakland too. But on the other hand, he's calling homeless people spoiled
mm-hmm.
because they got t-shirts and because they wanted some food. Like, Dior does not eat. See how skinny he got from the end of the season compared to the beginning?
I didn't notice that. Wow.
And he's dropping passes, and they're acting like it's just a skill thing. It's not a skill thing. He sleeps across.
Yeah.
He sleeps in a truck. You notice the truck didn't even have a CD player. He has, like, the tape drive. Remember, like,
yeah.
in the 90s, you would get a Discman and play the CD and then feed the tape adapter into your car's tape drive?
Yeah, I had that. Yeah, I'm surprised he had that Explorer. Yeah.
This is what I'm saying, but that's how old the car is.
Yeah.
Right? And he shows up at the barbecue at Grandma's house, and he's trying to time it so he does not have to see his dad.
Right.
Right? Because the dad's a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And
made him wear a dress to school one day.
Yeah. And the thing is, but he took the chance because he was not eating. He's like, I got to go to Grandma's house to get some food.
Yeah.
Right? So these are the circumstances. And then you have this coach saying these guys are spoiled. And I just wonder how out of touch you got to be, especially if you're the person who prides yourself, and again, on being able to connect with kids across cultural lines.
Didn't one of the coaches say, the assistant coaches say something like, yeah, you know, Coach Beam, he worked well with these kids, but in the 90s or whatever, but now it's time to upgrade in a way, like, and like yes. he said, like, in this time to, like, you got to try to reconnect with these kids. This is a yes. different breed, you know.
Yes. But again, part of it, he was talking about Coach Beam being the non-black person who knew black slang and black speech of a certain era.
Right, right.
Right. And hadn't updated his AAVE. So he's still over there talking about, hey, you know, hey.
Wait, can you put a pin in that? What do you think of AAVE? That's just the term in and of itself. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I like it because it has to exist because otherwise you have idiots that just say black people speak broken English. Black people don't have a language. All they have is slang.
Yeah.
All they have is Ebonics, and Ebonics isn't English. I'm like, no. It's English. It's a different type of English.
Okay. Well, the way you explain it is better.
and in the absence, too, of, like, one cool word.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because if we're in the English-speaking Caribbean, you just call it Patois. You
right.
know what it is.
Right.
Right?
Right.
If you're in Haiti or St. Lucie, well, St. Lucians call their Creole Patois. And in Haiti, they call it Creole as distinct from French.
Yeah.
Like French, but it's not French.
Right.
Yeah, one cool word. And when you say the word, people know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And here in America, because, like, the black people have no culture crowd,
mm-hmm.
have had so much of people's mind share for so long. You bring up the idea that black people do have culture and they want to get mad. They say black people don't have a language. All they have is slang. No, black Americans have a way of speaking.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, be happy with it. You know, and you know how we know we have a way of speaking? Because especially in the social media era, like, y'all are just on Twitter trying to figure out what the new words are.
Mm-hmm.
And incorporate them.
Yeah.
And run them into ground and tell us that we use them too much.
Yeah.
Isn't it like the word finnin was gonna, like, when I was growing up, finnin, like, who said finnin? Like, people said finnin, but, like, not a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it also was like a marker of, like, social class, you know? It was not something that just people just said.
We would get corrected because I had an aunt that was a school teacher and eventually a principal, and she would just correct us when we would talk slang.
Yeah, so my dad would say finna, my mom would never say finna.
Yeah.
My dad's mom, she was very proper, so she would always just say fixing too.
Yeah.
Right?
Same thing, yeah, yeah. What are you fixing to do?
But it was not a phrase that white people knew existed.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't a phrase you're ever going to hear outside of, like, black people who were, like, very urban or a little bit country.
Right.
Or, you know, on that end of the scale, like, bougie people weren't going to say finna.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But now, like, everybody says it. You know why people say it? Because of social media, because people see it now written out.
Yeah.
And they see people tweet it. But yeah, no, I prefer African American vernacular English. That phrase, I prefer that to Ebonics. I prefer it to the idea that black people don't have language.
Yeah.
Again, if we just had one cool word,
right,
to just sum it up, then it wouldn't even be a discussion. You just have a word.
It's just like, yeah.
If you watch like a documentary called Sweet Mickey for President, it's about Michel Martelly, the musician from Haiti. When he ran for president, he had to run against Wyclef Jean.
Okay.
And so Wyclef is running it, but Sweet Mickey, his big backer is Praz from the Fugees. So this is one of the subplots, right?
Mm, oh, shit.
You know, but a lot of it's not in English. A lot of it is subtitled. And some people are speaking French and some people are speaking Creole. And that's just what it is. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
All from Haiti. And then, you know, and a lot of people from Haiti, they code switch.
Right, yeah.
And one of the big things in the movie was that people didn't know that Michel Martelly could code switch. They didn't think he spoke straight French. They thought he only spoke Creole.
Mm.
But no, I speak French too. I code switch. And these are all things black Americans do.
Yes. Yeah.
Except for the fact that like mainstream America keeps trying to tell black Americans that we have no culture, even though they're always busy stealing from this culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in the absence of one cool word like Creole or Patois or Palenque, I will say African American English. Yeah. African American vernacular English. I'll take either one.
I just see whenever I see that on Twitter, it's just about fighting. And it's always just like,
yeah.
You're taking our language and you're fighting. So it kind of has that negative connotation. But when the way that you explain it, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. All right. Because I had to look it up the first time I saw it.
It'd be so much easier. Like I said, it'd be so much easier if we had one cool word that summed it up.
Yeah.
Better than Ebonics.
Yeah.
Right? But so here's Coach Beam. This is, you know, circa 1970-something African-American vernacular English.
Right.
Right? Hey, jive turkey.
Yeah.
Everything's out of sight, daddy-o. All this stuff. So, yeah, the kids think he's antiquated. But that's one level of, like, not being able to connect. But you can get around that. I'm talking about very fundamentally not realizing what these kids are up against when they come into this program.
Yeah.
While at the same time bragging about how tough they are.
Mm-hmm.
And have it. But then also shaming them for wanting a t-shirt. Like, this dude sleeps in his truck, man.
Yeah.
Of course he wants a t-shirt.
He didn't know? Like, I mean, he had to know, yes. Right?
Right. But I guess he might be limited in what he can do for them.
That's true.
Something becomes an impermissible benefit.
Yeah.
But at the same time, man, and he's got guys driving, like, what's his name? Rajon was driving from Stockton. That's like a 90-minute drive, I think.
Wow.
And so, like, don't bug people about feeling entitled. If I drive 90 minutes each way every day, go to class and go to practice, yeah, I feel entitled to a t-shirt. I feel entitled to more than a t-shirt. And these guys are on a scholarship. They're paying tuition.
And this is what I wanted to ask you about. Like, because to me, this does seem like the worst conditions for these kids to be playing in. And it's very deceptive because you look at, I've only spent like a few days in the Bay Area, just in San Francisco. And that was probably like the rich part because I was playing like Cobb's Comedy Club and that was like 7 years ago. And I remember just in those few days how expensive that area is, just like buying food and stuff.
Right.
What do you know about California? Because this seems to be like one of the most expensive areas in the country. And then like the living situations that these kids go through. And they have to play, and they go to school, and they have to play like football every week.
Yeah, I don't know more about California than the rest of us know.
Okay.
In terms of, we know that the Bay Area, like the Oakland, is gentrifying
right
rapidly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I couldn't tell you is where the black people from Oakland, where they're going now.
Yeah.
You know, like which suburbs they're landing in, or if they're going back down south or what. But yeah, but this is kind of the unspoken hustle of the last few seasons of Last Chance U.
Mm.
Like Eastern Mississippi, I don't know if they were giving scholarships. But the last idiot coach, JB from Independence, like he kind of let it slip, right? That the players, he's not giving scholarships. Like the players are paying tuition.
Oh, okay.
Which is why it's so easy for him to like bring people in. Because he is the football coach. He is not responsible for their financial aid. So there's less paperwork the football staff has to do with the financial aid office, right? But here's the hustle. It's that the football coach, whether it's JB or Laney, like he's selling the dream. Oh, you can go D1. You can go pro. Look at these pro guys that I coached. Come to my school. It's going to cost you. That'll be all right because you're going to get a scholarship when you leave here. You're going to go pro. It'll all pay off.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they're selling this dream to literally hundreds of people. And the roster at Independence had way more than 100 people in it. Right?
Yeah.
And like your typical D1 program has around 100 people. It'd be like 85 guys on scholarship and then 15 or 20 more like walk-ons. But what these schools can do now, right? The football program gets all these guys to notice the school. Football coach sells them the dream and says, hey, pay tuition for 2 years. It'll be fine because you're going to get a big scholarship. But if they're from out of state, they pay more tuition. So the school's like, fine, bring in as many of these guys as you want. Because now I have 150 people paying out-of-state tuition, whereas without a football team, I wouldn't have any of these people. And so it makes money for the school. And so this is the hustle these guys are running, right? And the schools love it because they just get they can boost enrollment and get a bunch of people that they know are paying full tuition, out-of-state tuition. And this is the hustle.
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. Well, no one ever tells it to you. You got to put it all together. But when Jason Brown in the previous season, he let it slip. That's what he was doing, that these guys weren't on scholarship. I was like, okay, now all this stuff makes sense. You just sell them this dream, you bring them in from all over, and the school is like, cool, as long as their tuition's paid, we're happy.
So
there
that,
it goes.
So is that why like a guy like Malik Henry from a couple seasons ago was just like, I'm going to leave, and I'm going to try to go somewhere else, and I'm going
to... Yeah, well, that's the other thing, because you're not tied to them by a scholarship.
Yeah.
So you don't have to like... go through all this drama that the scholarship dudes at D1 have to go through when they want to transfer. But again, like part of the goal here is just to get a bunch of dudes on the team from out of state because they're paying tuition. And so again, the school doesn't mind that because they promote the school, but they also pay tuition. And so it's like a diet version of it's a diet version of the hustle that the big state universities run, where they try to just bring in as many people as they can from China and from Korea, because you can charge them out of state tuition, right?
Yeah.
So the person from Seattle is paying however many $1,000 a year. The person from China is paying 10 times that because he's not from there. And so that's why they love recruiting those guys.
It's
a lower level version of that same hustle.
Yeah, this season to me just seemed to be more sobering just because of it just seemed like maybe because it's a major city in the country.
Yes.
And the way that I just know from living in a place like Chicago, living in a place like the New York City area where like you have to do all this stuff and you have to follow your dream, but you have to do all this other shit because I'm going to speak, you correct me if I'm wrong. I think we're two people that we're black, right? And we come from places of privilege where I assume that you got a scholarship to go to Northwestern, right?
No, I walked on to Northwestern.
So you walked on. Okay.
Yeah.
And then, but did you have any scholarship? You had to be smart when you were in high school, right? You get any money?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In that aspect, I was a nerd.
Yeah.
Like I had the grades. Like I didn't need the football coach to be like, get this guy in.
Okay. So I had the academics, and I like you, and I had so I had both parents working and everything, and busted their ass and put me in good places. But I just see like these kids, man. Like I don't know. I just felt for these kids more because it just seemed like the other kids had a place to stay. And
yes.
You know, it's like they just had a fucking place to sleep. And it just seemed like it was just more. Like, I got it playing on mute right now. Like, the I don't know what episode it's on now, but it's just it just seemed to be more sobering even. And then I don't know, the beauty of that area, like aesthetically, was just like all this shit is going on where and these kids are just fucking grinding it out hard. I don't know. It just this one did also, something to me.
This one also, it was a football program in a city where it's easy to forget that that program exists.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the first two locales, like East Mississippi and Independence College, they're both in these small towns where the only thing to do is to go, the only entertainment option.
Right.
To watch these guys play football.
That's true. Yeah.
Whereas here, like in the Bay Area, I'm sure there's all kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's very easy to forget that Laney College exists.
Yeah.
Because there's NFL not too far from there, or at least there was until the Raiders left, you know, but there's NFL, NBA, like all the major sports in the Bay Area. So who's checking for Laney College? So it is a program that is in a big city, and that's supposed to be a selling point, but that's also what makes it really marginalized.
Yeah.
And how this program is like, you're not sure how many more seasons this program is going to last.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas East Mississippi Community College, as long as there's nothing to do in East Mississippi, that program is going to thrive because there's nothing for anyone else to do or care about in terms of entertainment. And the other difference too was that the East Mississippi guys, like as a group, they were more talented. Like you could, you know, a bunch of them had come from Division One, and some of them you could tell were headed to Division One.
Yeah.
Whereas these guys, they weren't quite as big or as fast or as strong. So you see them doing this, and then you, but you also wonder like what the payoff is really going to be.
Right.
Like the first season when like John Franklin the III was playing, like yeah, you know, this guy's a stud. All he has to do is get himself back on track, and he's going to be someplace.
Yeah.
Big time. Because he has everything you need.
Mm-hmm.
But like Dior, kind of small. He's quick, but you're not sure how fast he is.
Yeah.
You know, he drops the ball sometimes, but again, he's sleep deprived, right?
He's fucking hungry and tired.
Isn't going to know that. Yeah. And so that's the other thing. Because even with Independence, like, there were still guys that had Division I potential, so it made sense that they were making this sense, what the sacrifice would lead to.
Right.
With these guys, some of them have that talent, but a lot of them, it's not clear. So now you're watching these guys work these full-time jobs and go to these classes at the school that's run down with a coach that thinks they're entitled, even though they're juggling all these burdens.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not sure how it's going to pay off for them. So that, yeah, that's what made it like a little bit more compelling, but tougher to watch from the standpoint of like cheering for someone to get a happy ending.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause this is the only, I just felt like as I was watching this, I was like, Jesus, this is really bad. Like this kid's working at Wingstop all hours of the night. And like, I did see that he's walked on at Hawaii and, talking about Dior and everything. Like he seems to be doing okay.
Yeah, except that he didn't have money, so I don't understand how he's getting his tuition paid and his housing and all this in Hawaii. He probably needs...
I don't know. I saw a story... I think you kind of broke up a little bit.
I was going to say, he probably needs two or three more jobs. He's not on scholarship.
Yeah.
And this is the other thing I didn't understand about the coach. Like,
he left. The coach from... the coach went to Washington State?
No, the... No. About Beam. Legendary
Beam.
He has all these contracts. And as much as he seemed to love Dior and favor Dior, he should also have been able to call some Division II school and say, I have a guy for you.
Yeah.
Like, Dior is tailor-made for Division II or lower Division I because he's a guy that, like, he's really good, but he doesn't profile
right
as a superstar. But if you're willing to see his potential...
And feed him.
Yes.
Give him a place to sleep.
If Dior gets 3 square meals a day and 6+ hours of sleep, he's a different player.
Yeah.
But you would think that legendary Coach Beam, with all his connections, should be able to call somebody and get a full ride for Dior someplace. it shouldn't come down to Dior having to walk on in Hawaii.
Right.
But, you know, I started the season loving legendary Coach Bean, but he wore thin, and I just, about halfway through.
When do you find out Dior's sleeping in his car? I forget what, I was like, what?
It was the first or second episode.
I was like, what the fuck is going on here?
He pulls it in the parking lot outside the little apartment complex. That was early on.
And then he has, and then he's got a job. Then he has a father. And it's like, what is going on here? I understand why he's away from his dad, but it's just like, you're a new dad. Like if I found out my kid is on the street somewhere and I have the means to do, I would feel like a failure. I would have to do something, like throw some money at it, give him some money or try to come. I don't know, man.
Absolutely. I don't know.
And it looked like
I left that season really unimpressed with Dior's dad.
Yeah.
It's like Dior's dad never occurs to Dior's dad that he's the problem.
No. It seemed like his dad's gainfully employed. They have a house. You look at the house, like, it's just like a lot of you just like, okay, they're doing okay. Like that kid does not have to be sleeping in his truck.
No.
He could give that money. It's like he could give some money to another family member and have another family member give it to him and say, it's not, you know, make sure that they say it's not from his dad or something.
Exactly.
Like that shit, even knew the Polynesian kid, he had it rough, but he had somewhere to live and he had support.
Yeah.
What did you think about him?
He's another one like, he was big, but again, like he's a guy that like, after you've seen Division I and NFL football players, you can see why he's not one. You know what I mean? Because there's a difference between being big and being big the way that like the high end D1 guys and the NFL guys are.
Yeah.
I just don't. But he's another one. Like, if he's got two kids, I can tell you right now, he's sleep deprived. He's probably sleep deprived as sleep deprived as Dior is. So maybe I shouldn't judge him so harshly.
Yeah.
Because with 7 hours of sleep every night, he might be ripped.
Right.
Right? He just has no time to do anything. So I'm surprised he even has time to play football. But he, at least towards the end of the season, like, you could see him start to view football as a job, and the wife starting to view football as a job, but like, like in a good way. Let me go someplace where I'll have a full ride. So that at least, you know, the housing and the food on my end are taken care of.
Yeah.
It'll lighten the burden on my wife, who right now is making all the money. I'm over here paying tuition.
Right.
I just worry about what happens for him after those 2 or 3 years, you know, in college. Like, what's happening with him right now at Murray State? Is Murray State playing football right now?
No.
Can they afford to play football? Right. But like in a normal world, you'd at least be happy that he's going someplace to get a full ride, housing stipend, food stipend, perfect. Like for him, that's as good as having a job.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes his wife's job a lot easier.
Do you feel like he was kind of holding himself back, like thinking about his kids and his wife, like why he didn't want to excel in a certain way, or do you just put it all on sleep deprivation?
No, I just don't know that he had ever been in a situation where people like expected anything of him academically.
Okay.
And so like him in the classroom, it just seemed like that was a language he didn't speak.
Yeah.
He was so much more articulate just in terms of expressing himself around the football guys.
Right.
Whereas in class, he was like 2 or 3 words at a time. I'm going to hand in my friend's essay, this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He just seemed so uncomfortable and out of his element there, but he just seemed like a guy that no one had ever expected him to do well in school.
Yeah.
And the teacher, like as much slack as she has to give all these guys, you could tell she still expected stuff.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Know how to handle it.
Yeah, because they weren't scholarship kids. Like, you know, you just burst my bubble on that.
Right.
What about RJ, the white wide receiver?
I just don't understand how you're a white guy with average speed, but you also are not a very good route runner.
At least fit one of the stereotypes.
Yeah. So if you're the white guy with okay speed, you have to be a really good route runner.
Yeah.
RJ just kept getting mad at the coaches for telling him, you know, what he needed to do. But like, you know, I played wide receiver in university. I could tell you what RJ was doing wrong. He didn't know how to run his route. So that's why he couldn't get open. So I don't know what else he wanted. He wanted to go to Oregon, but the guys at Oregon know how to run routes. If they don't come in knowing how to run routes, they learn really quickly.
Yeah.
Like, now, if you got Randy Moss speed, maybe you don't need to run super clean routes.
Yeah.
But if you got average speed, you got to run really good routes. That's as simple as I can make it.
Yeah.
And RJ didn't understand about, like, splits, where to line up, given what route he needed to run. You know, how to stem and set up a defensive back. How to adjust his route to the coverage. He didn't know any of that stuff. He just thought he was going to run to a spot and get the ball.
So he just blamed everything on the coach and then Dior being a wide receiver at quarterback?
Right.
He kind of had a rough go of it too, like where he was living. And then he finally got a car. Like he got a car to get to school.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So even like the white guy with the well-to-do family, and it, like as a person that's writing his first book, and he says that he moves in with his aunt and his uncle and their authors, and they have like an entire house paid for off of selling books. Like these people are Superman and Superwoman to me.
Yeah.
Because there's no money in writing books.
Right.
They had a pretty nice house just based on selling books. I don't even know how that's possible. Because I've seen book contracts. There's no money.
I guess it's that science fiction type thing that you just
I guess, man.
There's an audience for it. You just pump them out.
Yeah. But then, but the trade-off is they are certified weirdos.
Yeah.
Who had the pedophile dad.
Yeah.
And who have made excuses for the pedophile dad.
And
RJ's like, yeah, my grandpa's a piece of shit. And his aunt's like, well, no, he wasn't that bad of a guy. I wouldn't want to have to live with that person.
And that's why they don't mess with their mom, right? With his mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But everyone has to make that type of compromise, right? Just to live and pay tuition and go to school to play for Coach Beam, who thinks you're entitled because you got a T-shirt.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, okay. This is, and another interesting, we didn't get too much on Rajan Wright, who's the DB. I remember texting you like midway through this series, and I was just like, Delaney can't play defense, man. What's going on?
And Rajan, he liked to talk about his six offers, but maybe this is just the way the film was edited.
Yeah.
But, like his one superpower as a cornerback.
That he's tall?
Just seemed to be. No, outrunning RJ Stern in practice on go routes.
Outrunning the white wide receiver.
Yeah, that was his superpower. And then he'd go get in the game, and people would beat him like a drum. But he'd be like, I got six offers. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Maybe you should have 10 if you had more to offer. Yeah, but he's a guy, like, just from a football standpoint, like a tall cornerback is such a luxury.
Yeah. Like 6'3"? He's like 6'3", something like that?
Yeah, because cornerbacks were like the last group of football players, like the last position to get taller.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Because once you got into the 21st century and past 2005, you had Megatron and guys like this, like, you didn't see a ton of 5'10" wide receivers. Well, you're starting to see more of them now.
Because if they could catch, they'd be a wide receiver.
Right.
Yeah.
Or no one had like the imagination or was willing to take the risk to take the 6'3" guy who could be a receiver and make him a defensive back to cover the 6'3" receiver. But so you saw like a bunch of 6'3" receivers and all the defensive backs are still 5'10".
Who's the best cornerback in the NFL right now? The kid that
I don't know. That's hard for me to call off the top of my head. I don't have that like encyclopedic knowledge of people at each position that I used to have. Hard for me to say.
Well, you could tell me who's that? Why the cornerback that was with Jacksonville and then he got traded to the Rams?
Oh, Jalen Ramsey, I like him. Yeah,
yeah, that's the one. Yeah. He comes to mind.
Yes.
How? Let me see how tall he is, Jalen Ramsey. Yeah, because I always wondered about that. Like, is it just because, like, he is 6'1"?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And he went to, where did he go to school? Florida State. Yeah, okay.
He's with the Rams, not St. Louis.
Yeah.
But
does he just go to Oregon State because his brother's there?
Yeah, I think so. And again, I just don't know, like, based on, like, heading into the season, he said, I have 6 offers. But then based on, like, what we saw, he wasn't making a ton of plays in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know if more offers came.
Yeah.
Because, like, Oregon State's in the Pac-10, you know, because there's the Pac-10 and there's the Pac-10. There's the Oregon State, Washington State Pac-10.
Yeah.
And there's the USC, UCLA Pac-10.
Right.
And the Stanford Pac-10. And so, you know, if Stanford had come in and said, hey, here's a scholarship of USC, I'm sure he would have said, hey, I love my big brother, but I got to go play at USC.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen.
And then I wonder how much, like, I know it was a big deal for Dior to get out of Cali. I wonder how much that was for Rajon. Like, maybe they just wanted to get out. I don't know. They've.
Yeah, and I don't, like, I don't know. And again, just having watched him on, like, that season,
mm-hmm.
again, I just don't know, like, what besides his height was going to make the major programs within the state,
yeah,
you know, go out of their way to bring him in. If you're USC, even if USC isn't what they were in the Reggie Bush days, they're still USC.
Right, right.
And so, you know, they're still a program that can recruit nationally and internationally. And so, again, like, if his starting point is 6 offers and the biggest one is from Oregon State, I just didn't see anything in that season that would, like, get that to 10 offers, with the biggest one being from USC or Ohio State or something. You know what I'm saying?
That's true. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't, if I was in that situation, I would be chomping at the bit to go to Oregon State because it's still a big school.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And again, and these guys are coming from a school where the coach gets mad at them if they want a T-shirt.
Yeah.
You're still getting a full ride.
I love it that you keep bringing it up.
Yes.
They're paying their tuition. Just give me a fucking T-shirt, dude. Man. Wow. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Because they pay for the T-shirt because they pay tuition and they pay for it, their time and their effort. You're begrudging them a T-shirt.
In Beam's defense, though, they are cool T-shirts. Like, they're
very cool T-shirts.
These uniforms are pretty hot. Like, they're Nike uniforms. I would rock a Laney College T-shirt. That's pretty cool. Yeah, dude. Like that. Go ahead.
I was gonna say I would, except I don't want people thinking that I support Coach Beam.
Legendary Coach Beam. Yeah.
Right.
It would be for the kids, though. Like, this just was like, I just can't get over how bad this was. Like, the conditions these kids, what they had to do. Like, when I was a kid, when I was in college, my parents didn't want me to work because my job was college. I mean, I did work study my first year and stuff like that. But, like, they're like, no, you need to get your degree. Like, you have 4 years to get it. So.
Yeah, and it's also different. Yeah, when you can have an on-campus job.
Yeah,
and you're like, one of my jobs when I stopped playing football was, like, I worked in academic services at the athletic department.
Okay.
So one of my jobs was study hall monitor.
Yeah.
This is the best job out there because that's when you study.
Yeah, because you just kind of chill. It's kind of chill, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just get to the library at 6:30. The kids start getting there, and they all come within 15 minutes of each other.
Yeah.
And then they're all there for like 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
And then they all leave within 15 minutes of each other. So your total time investment is 3.5 hours. but you got 3 hours to catch up on your reading.
Oh, that's good. So this,
right, which is very different from me having to leave campus to go to Wingstop and go sling these chicken wings and then sleep in a truck and then go to practice and go to school.
Mm-hmm.
Very different things.
And then it just
which
had
is
that.
Why yeah. If I had done all that, don't get mad at me over a goddamn T-shirt. Man.
Yeah. And it just had that pressure of having to perform.
Yes.
Just to perform at this high level where it's like, dude, I've been, like you said, slinging these chicken wings all day, all night.
Right.
And I went to class. It seems like they go right. to class. It seems like all these kids, they go to class. Like you didn't see, oh, so-and-so missed class. Like this season, all these motherfuckers was in class.
I was going to say, much more so than in the previous two seasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's why they couldn't make a star out of an academic counselor who looks like a hero for strong-arming these people in the class.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It was the first, in Independence and at EM at East Mississippi, you had, like, the heroic woman who keeps these people eligible.
That's so true, because these guys were really good, and they didn't have to give a shit. They didn't really need to give a shit about fulfilling their requirements.
No, as a group, they had much better study habits.
That's and a like, great point. Wow. Yeah.
Self-ingrained study habits because they didn't need someone else always pushing them.
Yeah. Wow. That's a really good point, man.
But the coach is bugging them about a T-shirt. So how about this? We as a group, we won't complain about T-shirts, but we won't go to class. How's that?
Yeah. And didn't one of the kids, like, try to take his carrots or something? And he got mad at the kid for, like, eating his carrots, his snack.
I think so.
I would have just, if I was a coach, I would have just gave him the carrots.
Right.
Yeah. That,
take the carrots, man. Take the carrots, take the T-shirt. Because you're sleep deprived and starving. Because
even Coach Brown, what's the other guy, Brown? He bought them food and stuff. I would see them eating. Who was the coach that was kind of racist from the last year? Jason Brown?
Yes, that was cool. Yeah, it was Jason Brown. Yes, for sure.
I noticed them eating a lot more than these kids.
Yes, exactly.
I guess maybe that's
because
of...
because he had to deal with the sports bar, remember?
Okay. Because it was some... I just... Maybe... I was just thinking maybe because it's a more of a... Maybe it's a Southern thing, but these kids did eat more. Those kids ate more than these kids this season.
Yes.
Damn.
But that's also one of these things that maybe, like, if you are Independence Community College football,
yeah.
Again, like, you are the sports property in town.
Yeah.
If you want to get, like, a sponsor that's going to help give your kids food in exchange for signage at the games or whatever, you can do that. It's easy.
Yeah.
Because the sponsor, they're not going to advertise anyplace else that's going to get them as much attention. Whereas if you're Laney College,
mm-hmm.
like, how much headway can you really make with a local sports bar with like McDonald's or Subway or whatever saying, hey, why don't you give us, you know, $100,000 a year in free food and you can have your signs all over our game.
Yeah.
McDonald's or Subway said, that's not going to do anything for us. We're better off keeping all this stuff in our pocket. But that was the point where he lost me.
Right.
Keeping all that, because I couldn't forget, like, how much the players are up against just to get there. And this guy's over here complaining about a T-shirt.
They're soft. Damn, man. Yeah, this one was really sobering for me. Like, and it's so weird. Like, you got a kid that has a black dad, but, like, and the black dad has money. And he's just, like, it's just the relationship is so...
Toxic.
Yeah, toxic that it's like, man, because you like, okay, the latest, this episode now, you look at how beautiful where these people, I think this is Rajon, this is Stockton. Stockton mm-hmm. just looks like anywhere USA. It looks like they're not poor. And then I don't think they're poor. Like Rajon, this is Rajon's, they're following him. And he's like, I guess, in Stockton. And it's just suburban. It's just really beautiful houses.
But that was the mom. But that was the plot line with the mom, right?
That had the grind, the work at the shipping yard.
Yeah, because that's good paying work. It's a union gig.
Yeah.
But you can't live in Oakland anymore, even on what they make.
Right. You got to move. Like, you got
to
go out.
We're going to get a house that's decent sized.
Yeah.
So she had to go out to Stockton, and that's the trade-off they make, right? And so they're both driving an hour and a half each way to do what they got to do.
Yeah. And that's like just to get that piece of the pie, like that American.
Right.
That's what a lot of people, I just noticed, like, that's like in the Maryland, D.C. area. Like, now D.C.'s like, everybody's going back to, they coming back. Oh, shit, I want to talk to you about this, too. Like, how everybody, and then we'll have to wrap this up. I don't want to hold you too long. But this has been fucking great, Morgan. I noticed, like, all the black, because black people, P.G. County, like, all this, like, highest concentration of some wealth in black America or some shit. I forget what it was. But now that everybody's coming back to D.C., like, the black people are moving out, and then there's more black people in southern Maryland, like Charles County. Like, we're all down there now. Like, I remember, like, last Christmas, it was just, like, me and my dad went to Sam's Club down there, and then we went to the grocery store. I hadn't been down there in years, and I just saw how it was a lot of us down there. It was like, wow, because it used to be different. And everybody else, like, you just move, like, to Southern Maryland and, like, Central Virginia, kind of, and then you still commute back up to D.C. to work these government jobs.
So that's who it is. So people are getting pushed. Are they getting priced out of D.C.?
In a lot of ways. I mean, it seems like it's happening in a lot of major cities. Like, I'm just kind of speaking on what I see, not numbers. Mm-hmm. But I just noticed from having friends that live there, my parents are still in that area. There's black people, obviously, in PG County still, but just like in the DC area, you starting to see more white people in the city, and right. Like and after, I don't know if that was like over a 20-year span or what, but I noticed now, like I live in this city, Hackensack in New Jersey.
Yeah,
they're starting to build like these high rises now, like these luxury condos and apartments, and they're throwing it up because people are getting priced out of Manhattan. Not only right. Well, they've been getting priced out of Manhattan,
yeah, exactly.
They're getting priced out of Brooklyn and Queens, right. And all the and like now they're coming over here, and it's going to be even more congested. It's just like it's crazy.
Yeah, and that's. Like a completely different topic, but like
I know, yeah, but we can.
Even in the context of this season of Last Chance U, right? Is mm-hmm. these guys? You're either homeless in the city or living in a shipping container,
mm-hmm.
or you're at the point where you can't. Like the suburbs are also too expensive, and you have to live in the exurbs.
Yeah,
and so like Stockton and Oakland, you know, I'm sure, like. Whenever I heard of those two cities, I thought of them as distinct cities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of one as a hub and the other as a suburb. But
right.
What Rajan and his mom show is they're like, no, Stockton is an exurb of Oakland.
Yeah.
it's 90 whole minutes away.
Right.
But this is what you have to do if you want to have a decent job, but also have a decent house. Because the mom was making good money in Oakland, makes good money in Oakland, but what can she buy in Oakland?
Yeah.
That's in a place that's gentrifying as quickly as Oakland is.
One of my favorite scenes, can you speak on this too? Like my favorite scene this year was the cop that was, it was just like, yes. And he was just talking about how the city's changed and he was just like, yeah, you know, there's gentrification and all this stuff. But at least the crime's down. Like you want to, if you live in a city and you pay all this money to live in a city, you should be able to have a good time and walk out in the street and enjoy yourself if you're not harming anybody without fear of being robbed or getting your head busted open.
The question that debate always raises for me is like, why do only the rich newcomers deserve to live mm-hmm. with no crime.
Right. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And in an environment that doesn't foster crime.
Right.
Because in any neighborhood with a lot of crime, there's also a lot of people that don't like crime. That don't commit
exactly.
crime.
That's true too. That's true too.
Why don't they deserve for the city to come in and not just and not do it the uncreative American way, which is just round up as many people as you can and shove them in jail. But no, like, why don't they deserve like a city, a society?
Yeah,
built in a way that like benefits them.
It's just happening. It's happening everywhere. It's like even like in Newark when we got the hockey team, the Devils moved down to Newark, and it's just so like, you got to get all the white people out of Newark safe, to get them back to the suburbs. And because I used to do a lot of shows down there when I was starting out, like doing stand up, like in the Ironbound section, which is like the multicultural, the Portuguese section. And then it was right by the arena. And I just remember like how they'd have cops over there. You start to see different things like sprawling up in that downtown area. You see like, it's gentrified when you see a middle-aged white guy doing like skateboard tricks at 9 o'clock at night. You know, it's just like, wow, this is different. This is not the Newark man raps about.
Yeah. But again, for all the people that lived there before that weren't into crime, how come you couldn't do this for us when we were here? This is like if you got an ex, mm-hmm. And she was like a chain smoker, mm-hmm. And all the whole time you're together, you're trying to get her to stop smoking, she don't stop smoking, she knows you hate smoke. And then y'all break up. And 6 months later, she's like, yeah, stop smoking. And I took my extra money and I invested it in the stock market. Now I'm rich because I'm not, my lungs feel good, and now I'm not spending all my money on cigarettes anymore. And you're like, what's that? How come they deserve that and I didn't deserve it?
Yeah.
I asked you to stop smoking, you wouldn't do it. I wasn't enough for you. So that's kind of how that feels when I see this happen.
Yeah. I just see these stories all the time. And like now with COVID, like you see these stories in the New York Times where it's like, or just wherever on Twitter, just about these people coming to these cities that were like in Brooklyn, these neighborhoods. And they have no sense of the culture or what's going on. And they want to complain when people are just outside talking on the porch, like on the stoop or something. It's just like it's what makes a city unique, like city life, city living is like communal and people are outside talking and you're just like, oh, could you be quiet? And it's like, no, go back to Iowa.
What do you want? Thank you. Exactly.
And now people are fucking going back. Like people are going back. It's like there was this piece. I didn't read all of it, but it was just like people talking about, oh, I'm moving back to Connecticut because New York's not the same. It's not the same after the virus. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like there's people, there's local stores that are open. There's people grinding it out. Like, because they don't have another place to go. They live in New York City.
Exactly.
They don't have anywhere else to go, and they're making it happen. But because you're just a tourist, so yeah, maybe you are moving back to Connecticut. Maybe you are moving back upstate. But don't try to belittle these people that have nowhere else to go and are still carving out a living for themselves.
Yes.
Just when it got a little rough, you know, it's rough for everybody, but you're just going to move out and just some of these people are just like, I wish you would just stay gone. Stay gone.
Well I can't come to a place and then complain about the very things that make the place the place. Like I don't come to Canada and complain about all the hockey. Like we know the Canadians do, they like hockey,
right?
Even if you don't like hockey, you make peace with hockey because hockey's here.
Yeah.
I don't come to Canada and say, oh, you guys need Put the sticks away, guys. You're inconveniencing me. That's not how it works. So if I'm going to go to New York, place where people kick it on the stoop, then I just got to be happy with people kicking it on the stoop because I'm the one that decided to come to a dense multicultural city where people like to kick it on the stoop.
Yeah, and that's, to me, like, I just never got that. Like, I mean, I grew up in the Maryland, D.C. area, which is, it's a, you know... It's multicultural and all that stuff, and it's all these ideas and all this stuff going on. But like, it really didn't hit home for me until like I moved to Chicago and started really being in a real city, like living in a city and experiencing that, the diversity and all this stuff. It's like you go to a certain city to live in that city, and I think about like New York, which is even larger, and you like that late 2007, 2008, where you start to see New York changing, like there shouldn't be a Target in Brooklyn. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like it shouldn't be, there shouldn't be like a Chuck E. Cheese or a Buffalo Wild Wings. I don't want to. It's like I had a good buddy of mine, Justin Williams, who's a professor, also a comedian. He was just talking. He's from the Midwest, and he was just saying like, "Hey, you know, you move to the city, to another city to be." I'm paraphrasing what he said, but like to live in its culture, the way that they do things, and like now people are moving to these cities and trying to put Anywhere USA, the homogenous nature of Anywhere USA, into Brooklyn. And it's
and bring the suburbs into the city.
Yeah.
Why? Like if you want your city to look like the city next door to look like the city next door to that, that's what the suburbs are for.
Yeah, and then it's not fun. It's not then, you know, it doesn't make the suburbs fun anymore. You know what I mean? Like it's like, I wouldn't consider Evanston. Like I think of like I'm more of Skokie. Like when I was in the city, you'd be like, oh, if I'm in Skokie, I can go to Best Buy now, or I can go to like Target or Walmart or something. But things that I can't do in the city normally, it's neat when you can do it in the suburbs. But it's like now all of that stuff is kind of, it's combined now. And it's just like, well, there's nothing is unique anymore.
Exactly.
No. So let me get off my soapbox on that. Morgan, this has been great, man. You're a new dad. How old is your daughter now?
Oh man, she's 15 and a half months. You guys might have heard her crying in the background. Nap time.
Okay.
She stayed up through nap time, and she woke up earlier than she was supposed to today, and then she stayed up through nap time, so she's cranky.
Oh, okay.
But, we'll see what's happening when I get off of here.
Yeah.
But it's good, man. She's at that age now. She can walk, and now she can run. Now she wants you to chase her everywhere.
How has it changed you as a person?
Like the main thing is that like you can't put yourself first anymore, right? Every decision you make, you gotta figure out.
I know.
How does this affect baby?
Yeah.
Right. And so, it's different, but that. I don't mind it. And the other thing...
Well, that's good.
Well, the other thing, too, is that I have always been able to function on 6 hours sleep.
Yeah.
So, in that aspect, I'm not struggling. Like, my wife loves to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's like, oh, my... Because she likes, you know, 9 hours of sleep. And so, especially the first when the baby's a baby, you know, wakes it's up a hard. Couple times a night.
Yeah.
That was really rough. Because that was when we're both down to 4 hours of sleep every night. But at least I was going from 6 hours to four. So I was like in the neighborhood, I could still function. It was really hard on my wife because she likes the full, you know, 8-9 hours. But, you know, that feeling of sleep deprivation, you learn to live with it.
Right.
And then you also have the luxury, like, you know, I took a buyout for my last job. I'm still working, but I just have a little more control over my hours in that sense. Mm-hmm. So when in the middle of the day, when the baby goes to sleep, I can go to sleep.
Yeah.
Because I don't have a 9-to-5. I don't have people that need me to be a certain place any time of day. And I can always adjust my schedule in other ways, but I love it. It's, you know, and you lose the spontaneity as well.
Yeah.
Because you know, anytime you're going to go out, like, you got a plan. Are we bringing the baby or are we finding a babysitter? Whatever. But it's so much fun. It's worth it. It's worth the sleep deprivation. It's worth, like, the loss of spontaneity. Well, it's worth it for me because I like kids. Like, each person has to decide for themselves how much they like kids.
Right.
Because, you know, it is not for everyone. It is not.
Well, yeah, that is true,
right? But this is something people got to be honest with themselves about too, right?
Yeah, you don't want to be like Dior's dad.
Yeah, because if you don't like kids, or if you can't take adjusting your sleep schedule, like if it really means that much to you, never adjust your sleep schedule, then you need to think twice,
mm-hmm.
maybe three times about having kids. But like, if you like kids, because it's a lot of fun, you just don't sleep as much.
Yeah.
And you know, if it really bothers you to have a little person throw up on you, like if that fundamentally bothers you, then maybe it's not for you.
As long as
getting pooped on every now and then, getting thrown up on every now and then, it's still worth like, you know, the fun. This is not a value judgment. That's not for everyone. It isn't.
As long as she's not throwing up on your Jordans. I mean, come on, dude.
The thing is, you can even throw up on my shoes. Like, as long as she doesn't throw up on the computer keyboard.
Your MacBook. Yeah.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about your book. You're writing your memoir.
Right. Yeah, man. So basically, I've been tinkering with some creative nonfiction for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I left the Toronto Star at the end of 2019,
mm-hmm.
You know how people do. They do a Twitter thread. I'm leaving my job. Here's what I want to do, blah, blah, blah. And I mentioned that I was doing some creative nonfiction. And so... this book publisher, he's the head of publicity for Penguin Random House Canada. So he's like an actual guy in the industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like straight into my DMs, like, well, what do you want to do? Let's talk. Okay, cool. So we're emailing back and forth trying to find a date, but he's like super presumptuous. Like, he's emailing me like he knows me. I'm like, this is strange. This guy's acting like we're super familiar. As opposed to him just emailing me because he knew I was a journalist.
Yeah.
And the thing is, his Twitter avatar is the picture of a gorilla.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So finally, we set up this meeting. I got to see him face to face, and I remember who he is. I knew him. We used to work out at the same gym. I said, oh, okay, that explains why he was so presumptuous and like really talking to me like he knew me. Because we do know each other. So anyway, he asked me to tell him about the idea. So I'm like, yeah, so what I want to do is like a memoir, but like in essays.
Okay.
So I'm sure like a lot of your audience has read or is familiar with Damon Young's book, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker.
Yes, yeah.
And then there's another one from a Canadian author, a guy I used to work with at the Star named Cathal Kelly. And his memoir is called Boy Wonders.
Mm-hmm.
So I told the executive, I was like, think of those two books. Mine kind of splits the difference between the two of them. So it's a lot of growing up stories about growing up in Canada, but it's also about growing up black. Like for me, it's about growing up black and American in Canada with two halves of your family that don't get along. So like my mom's family, my dad's family, they don't get along.
Oh.
Because of this perceived difference in social class between the two of them.
Even though they're very much God. I get it.
Exactly.
That's more of an off-mic conversation, but yeah. Yeah.
The key word is perceived. Perceived difference in social class between two sides of the family, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's stuff, whatever, I can write about it and laugh about it now, but it was drama, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm writing about. It was a lot of, you know, fertile ground for storytelling there between the idea that, like, this black American family had to come to Canada to try to pursue the American dream. Because they didn't think... the American dream was really achievable in the United States at a price that was reasonable to them. They had to give up too much to chase the American dream in the U.S. So a bunch of us came to Canada. And the idea too, that like we were minorities because we're black people in a country where most of the people are white, even among black people in Canada, black people around Toronto, I should say, we're minorities because we were American and most of the other black people were Caribbean. So in all these different conflicts and all this different tension is where a bunch of cool stories come from.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing.
So where are you in the process? Are you, did you finish the first draft or are you just in the
good one. Uh-huh. So basically what happens is I did a proposal.
Uh-huh.
And the proposal was about 50 pages long, but it had some sample chapters.
Yeah.
So there's a chapter about like my family and the way we fight.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way I explain it is, we don't fight like not like the Hatfields and McCoys, where you know you go shoot some other family,
mm-hmm.
but we fight. like what we love in our family is like the all out, like a hockey or a baseball brawl.
Okay.
Everyone decides and you fight for like years and years and years till you forget what the original fight was about. And then it dies down and then something else happens. And then usually like the person intensively, it was always my mom's dad. He was like, if it's a baseball brawl, like my mom's dad is like the first guy off the bench.
Okay.
You know? So if two other people are fighting, it has nothing to do with him. He jumps in to make the, and not to break up the fight, to make the fight bigger. So there's a chapter about that stuff and like all the different fights that we had to go through, like growing up, like my mom's family in this white neighborhood in Chicago. There's a chapter about like my parents dealing with Jamaicans. Hopefully this chapter survives in this form. The name of the chapter is "Nigga, This Ain't No Goddamn Jamaica," which is what my dad had to yell at our Jamaican neighbor, our next door neighbor, who came from Jamaica with a bunch of cockroaches like in his furniture.
Oh God!
So we started getting cockroaches in our house, and so dad and the neighbor get into it, and my dad ends the argument by saying, "Nigga, this ain't no goddamn Jamaica."
What's it like for you to excavate those stories from your life that may have been traumatic or tumultuous? How do you filter that
I'm
in?
Still doing it.
Yeah.
A lot of it was hard at the time. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the stuff you can like laugh about now.
Yeah.
And inject some humor into the retelling.
Mm-hmm.
Even around stuff that was like traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's different for me because I'm just, as a journalist, I'm used to writing about other people.
Right.
And so even before you get to like the idea that you got to gouge the marrow out of your bones, you know, and drag it out on the page for people to read. Even before you get there, it's just a matter of like figuring out which parts of your life and your family's life are interesting to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of what we've lived, like other people find interesting, but to me, it's hard to think of it that way because it's just my life.
Yeah.
It's my family's life. So even like when my mother tells me stuff about the people they would meet growing up, we're fascinated, but to her, that's his life, right?
Yeah.
My mom's father was a musician. And so they would come across like, they'd come home from school and like Oscar Peterson's just chilling. You know, he's on the couch hanging out with their parents. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like famous musicians would just come through the crib. And like, if I tell this to other people, they're impressed. My mom's just like, yeah, that was our life. That's just what it was. It was completely normal. Right.
Oscar Peterson's a famous Canadian jazz pianist.
Yes. Yeah. He is like one of the top two or three in that genre, like ever.
Okay.
He and my grandfather are really good friends for a while, like back in the 50s and 60s. He was probably like the first actual Canadian my grandfather ever met.
Okay.
But, so stuff like that. Right. So anyway, yeah, it's a process. It is a tough process of like peeling back different layers to get to the actual story,
mm-hmm.
and then getting rid of all the other stuff and figuring out what the actual story is there. And it's for me anyway, it's harder to do with myself than it is to do with when I'm telling other people's stories.
Yeah.
But again, because too, like so much of the story that I'm writing kind of revolve around like the last year of my dad's life. My dad died, I was 17. But and again, it's stuff we can laugh about now. Like back then it was not funny at all.
Right.
We can laugh about it because we all survived it, right? And so a lot of it just has to do with the timing, when you decide to tell the story, how you feel about it. Like is that wound still bleeding, or has it scarred over to the point where you can evaluate it? But yeah, it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad for the opportunity to do it, for sure.
That's great, because it's fascinating to me, because I ask you because You know, that's something that I think about when I'm doing stand up and the stories that I want to talk about, and you try to excavate the some things that may have been traumatic in the past to make it funny, and to make it not only make it funny, but just to make it palatable for a general audience. Yeah. So I always like to hear people's process.
Yeah. And so much of it is how you line up the facts. Because I write this, it's not completely chronological. Like, you read the stories, they jump back and forth. They're broadly chronological, but they jump back and forth in time. So much of it is just taking a series of events and like taking them apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then putting them back together in a way that emphasizes something besides the chronology.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, the chapter I wrote about people, how we fight in the family, you know, that goes from present day to 1920s Chicago to 1950s Chicago to, you know, when I graduated college.
Yeah.
All in the same essay. And then another of the chapters that's part of the proposal is like me, like as a high school senior trying to get laid.
Right? Yeah.
And most of that story takes place within the context of like one walk down the hall of the high school with this girl that I was trying to get with.
Yeah.
But like you weave in between all this other stuff.
Right.
So it's just, it's one thing to take the facts like on a ride from point A to point B. Another thing, again, to take all these points between A and B, take them apart, and then put them back together to emphasize themes as opposed to just the order of events.
Right. Do you have a title for it yet?
The title I've been working with is Soul Citizenship, but you know, I wouldn't bet money on that being the title at the end of this thing.
Mm-hmm. It's probably going to be a phrase from one of the stories.
Yeah, because basically, as I wrote in the proposal, like my mom's parents were the first ones to come here.
Mm-hmm.
And when they moved here, this was the first time in their lives that they felt like full citizens.
Right.
You could just live where you wanted. I guess my grandfather had lived in white neighborhoods in Chicago, but it always came at some other kind of cost.
Mm.
Whereas here, whatever neighborhood you want to live in, like you could live there. If you could afford it, you could live there. You didn't have to worry about white people trying to keep you out.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to worry about rednecks throwing rocks at your house, which happened in Chicago.
Yeah.
All of this stuff. You know, you could vote, and so much stuff was like free, healthcare, all this stuff. Like the first time they felt like whatever the country they had chosen had also chosen to embrace them.
Right.
That was a feeling that they'd never had in the United States. But that is also part of the story too, right? Like this racial utopia that Canada promises but doesn't deliver.
Right.
But just my grandparents weren't in a position to notice that just because they had put up with so much blatant, overt, bash you over the head racism their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
That like more benign forms of racism to them wouldn't even necessarily register as racism, you know? Like Canada is the land of Malcolm X's six-inch knife.
Hmm.
You know, that quote from Malcolm X, you can't stick a knife in my back 9 inches, pull it out 6 inches, and call it progress.
Got you. Yeah.
Canada's the three-inch knife. That's Canada.
Yeah. Well, Morgan, this has been a pleasure, as always. I hope I can get an advanced copy when you're done. And have you on to talk about it and shoot the shit about another sports reality show that both of us like.
Absolutely. The final, I have a bunch of preliminary deadlines, but the manuscript is due next July.
Okay.
It's supposed to hit stores spring 2022. So we got some time.
Yeah, we got time. And man, congratulations on the new bundle of joy. And all the cool stuff that you're doing, man. It's always a pleasure to shoot the shit and talk to you about real issues and stuff.
And always good to be on the show and to talk about stuff and not feel like I have to talk about sports, even though we always want to talk about sports.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's like, it's kind of your job, but you make the podcast infinitely smarter. So
there you go. That's what I try to do.
Because I just say, that's racist, but not why it's racist. It's just... Oh, that's man. All right, man. Well, hold on to the line. Thank you, Morgan, again for doing this. And thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.